body. That DNA testing was performed. Male DNA was found on that murder weapon, and it excludes Marcellus Williams. He is not the person who left that DNA on the knife. Based on all of that evidence, the prosecutor reviewed the case, brought forward this motion to overturn Mr. Williams' conviction on the basis of innocence, as well as on the basis of these constitutional violations, including racial discrimination. But on the day before the evidentiary hearing, new DNA testing came in that showed that the DNA on that knife could be consistent with the trial prosecutor's DNA and the trial prosecutor's investigator. At the evidentiary hearing, we've now learned that they mishandled that knife. They touched it without gloves in 2001 repeatedly, essentially destroying any potential probative value this critical evidence would have, which is what the prosecutor now also concedes was a constitutional violation.
So, Tricia, who is in charge at the U.S. Supreme Court of this case? What has to happen today?
So the stay motions go to Justice Kavanaugh, but the courts are going to be reviewing all of the cert petitions, the requests that the Supreme Court take on the case, as well as the motions to stop the execution. There are three petitions pending before the U.S. Supreme Court right now. The first is regarding the governor, Parson, had dissolved what was called a board of inquiry that was created to review all of this evidence. He dissolved it, even though Governor Eric Greitens had appointed it. So the first is regards to whether or not he was able to do that. The second is whether the federal court should have reopened the case to allow this new evidence of racial discrimination in the jury selection to be heard. And the last one filed last night is about what weight should the prosecutor be given.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
We want you to join us Saturday, September 28th from 2 to 5 p.m. for a special live broadcast during the Compassionate Living Festival, which runs from noon to 6 p.m. at Norse Hall in Portland. Tune in for our coverage featuring keynote speaker Erin Wing, an undercover investigator sharing her experiences with animals raised for slaughter. We'll also have panel discussions with experts on the benefits of a plant-based diet for people, animals, and the planet. That's September 28th, 2 to 5 p.m., live on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portlanders' dreams of being home to a Major League Baseball team get one step closer to reality. The city of Gresham wins an award from the EPA, and it's the last week for Oregonians to chime in on the state's transportation overhaul next year. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. I'm Althea Billings. Portland just got one step closer to getting its own Major League Baseball team. The Portland Diamond Project is the group that's been searching for a place to build a baseball stadium in and around Portland for years. They considered Lloyd Center, the Port of Portland, even Red Tail Golf Center in Beaverton. Now, they say they've signed a letter of intent to buy the Zidell Yards on Portland's south waterfront to turn into the stadium. The site was once where the Zidell family's company built barges. Since then, the site has sat mostly empty, though it did play host to some socially distanced events during the COVID lockdown. The agreement between Portland Diamond Project and the Zidell family says the group has roughly 3.5 years to close the deal and buy the property. It also likely means that if the MLB doesn't approve an expansion to Portland, the deal is off. Well, how are Portland's chances? Pretty good, at least according to ESPN. None of the other leading contenders for a new team is on the West Coast, only Portland. There's no set date when Portland might find out if they'll get an MLB team, but the baseball commissioner, Rob Manfred, said he would like to have a process in place for that expansion before he retires in 2029. The City of Gresham and the Pollution Prevention Resource Center win an award from the Environmental Protection Agency for their workshops teaching residents about safer alternatives to dangerous chemicals. The EPA recognized different organizations across the Northwest with the Safer Choice Partner of the Year Award. Here's more on the workshops that Gresham and PPRC provided to residents.
Hi there, I'm Greg Hayward with the City of Gresham, Oregon.
I'm Angel Contreras Cruz from Pollution Prevention Resource Center.
Also helping out on this project was Carrie Hondelet from the City of Gresham.
In 2023, we worked together to promote the EPA Safer Choice Program with Hispanic cleaning professionals, as well as BIPOC and historically underserved communities in the City of Gresham. We engage with clients who are not familiar with Safer Choice through community events and workshops, providing information in English and Spanish, and providing samples of Safer Choice certified products.
Our work helped increase awareness of Safer Choice cleaners, specifically with folks who are often more impacted by environmental issues and have had less access to these safer, greener cleaners in Gresham and neighboring areas.
We are thrilled to receive the EPA Safer Choice Partner of the Year Award 2024. We thank the EPA for considering our work as a valuable contribution to advancing the program. It is an honor to be recognized. We hope our work helps to continue to bridge the greener, safer, cleaner awareness and access gap for Hispanic cleaning professionals, BIPOC, and other historically underserved communities.
We are excited to continue this work and look forward to continued collaboration.
Thank you!
That was Greg Hayward and Angel Contreras Cruz talking about the EPA award they received for training Gresham residents on safer alternatives to dangerous chemicals. Early next year, the Oregon legislature will come back into session and work on passing the 2025 Comprehensive Statewide Transportation Plan. It's the last week for Portland metro area residents to attend a public hearing on the matter with the Joint Committee on Transportation. There are two this week, one on Thursday, the 26th, at Nelson High School in Happy Valley from 5 to 7 p.m. The other is on Friday at the Hillsborough Civic Center from 5 to 7. Residents who want to testify about their transportation needs and where they think the state should go to improve its transportation network need to register at the site. Advocates are pushing state lawmakers to fully fund safety programs like Safe Routes to School, as well as public transit and active transportation networks across the state. Another key priority for local advocates like the Street Trust is a complete street. It's described as an approach to planning and designing a street that's safe for all road users, including pedestrians, cyclists, drivers, and transit riders. Complete streets are also accessible for people with disabilities. A complete street looks different depending on where it is and what the community around it needs, but it will often include more bike lanes, sidewalks, turn lanes, and crosswalks. Those design features are prioritized over vehicle speed, which takes a back seat to safety features that reduce the likelihood of injury or deaths for pedestrians or cyclists. Washington State has made changes to the process for curing ballots in the event of mismatched signatures. The August primary proved the new process was consequential to the outcome. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
The results from the recent Washington State primary election proved the impact of a new law for voters curing their signatures on ballots. During the 2024 session, state lawmakers passed legislation that streamlines the process for voters to fix or cure their ballots if their signatures don't match the ones on record. The law went into effect in June, ahead of the August primary. It proved especially consequential in the public lands commissioner race, which was decided by a mere 49 votes. Stuart Holmes is director of elections with the Washington Secretary of State's office.
There was thousands and thousands of ballots that were initially challenged that were cured by voters through returning the cure form or submitting a alternative identification through these new reforms, and every one of those mattered.
Supporters of the ballot curing law say voters of color and young voters were disproportionately having their ballots rejected because of signature issues. They add the curing notification process needed to be standardized to help fix this issue. However, the Washington GOP has filed a lawsuit against King County over its use of a system called OmniBallot to validate signatures in a recount of the Public Lands Commissioner race. Haley Watkins with King County Elections says her office saw a marked improvement in cure rates during the August primary, 69% compared with a normal rate of about 50%. She says that's because the process now includes the ability for voters to cure their ballots in many ways, such as with their Social Security numbers, Washington State ID numbers, or other documents.
We saw many, many voters turn to those more simple ways to cure their ballots. So rather than having to match what they think their signature might look like on their voter registration record, they can provide us with information that they already have and we already have.
Holmes says improving the ballot curing process creates more trust in the election system.
No matter who it is we're talking to, everybody just wants every valid vote to count. And we want to ensure that there are the proper protections in place to protect the voters and the integrity of the process at the same time.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Trump says no more presidential runs, Nebraska is unlikely to change its Electoral College rules, and Ohio will vote on changes to how districts are drawn. With these stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
No, I don't. No, I don't. I think that that will be it. I don't see that at all. I think that hopefully we're going to be successful.
For the first time, former President Donald Trump says he won't run for president again. Previously, Trump described his victory as inevitable, but Sunday on Sinclair Broadcasting's Full Measure, he was much more restrained. Prosecutors plan to charge Ryan W. Ruth with attempted assassination. The man arrested after waiting with a rifle near where Trump played golf left a letter in his car saying he tried his best to kill the former president. He's being held without bond. Critics of an Israeli intelligence operation against Hezbollah in Lebanon say it would be illegal under U.S. law, which forbids using civilian items as weapons of war. On CBS, former CIA Director Leon Panetta calls booby-trapping pagers and walkie-talkies to explode terrorism.
I don't think there's any question that it's a form of terrorism. And when you have terror going into the supply chain, it makes people ask the question, what the hell is next?
Nebraska looks less likely to start awarding its Electoral College votes winner-take-all. Maine and Nebraska are the only states that award Electoral College votes by congressional district. The crucial Republican state senator representing Omaha says it's too close to the election to change that. Federal workers are voicing concerns about Project 2025, the hard right roadmap for a second Trump term. Trump denies involvement, but Jacqueline Simon with the American Federation of Government Employees says Trump allies helped write the Heritage Foundation document. She says privatizing government agencies and making tens of thousands of federal workers political appointees would have nationwide impacts.
There's a misconception that most federal employees live and work in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And the truth is that 85% of federal employees are work elsewhere around the country.
In Ohio, campaigning's underway over Issue 1, which would take the power to draw district maps from lawmakers and give it to a bipartisan citizen commission. Supporters say the current system lets politicians protect their seats with unconstitutional gerrymandering. But Mark Weaver with Vote No on Issue 1 says Ohio already has reforms in place.
We should allow them to work. They're relatively new. But Issue 1 would strip out the anti-gerrymandering provisions that Ohio voters put in.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A Native-run South Dakota health clinic celebrates 5 years of self-determination, exercising the tribe's right to provide its own health care. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Oyate Health Clinic in Rapid City is celebrating 5 years. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lee Strubinger reports, officials are marking the beginning of the clinic when tribes exercised Indian Self-Determination Act laws to provide their own health care.
Oyate Health Clinic started out serving 12,000 patients and was operating in a building constructed in the late 19th century. Now, the clinic is in a new facility and is serving nearly double the number of patients. Geraldine Church is the president and CEO of Oyate Health Clinic. The Minikoju Lakota says Oyate Health incorporates culture into healthcare. Church says Oyate's approach is what sets them apart from other health systems.
We listen to our relatives. We don't refer to the people we serve as patients or clients or consumers. They are our relatives, and we treat them as such. So before we incorporate any new policy, any new service, any change in how we provide healthcare, we get feedback from the community and we ask them, and we continually ask them how we're doing.
Church says the clinic is looking to expand services. Healthcare is a treaty right for tribal members. Ryman LeBeau is the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribal Chairman, as well as Chairman of the Great Sioux Tribal Leaders Health Board. He was at the Sioux Sand Building 5 years ago when tribes took control of the former boarding school and tuberculosis sanatorium. The Two Cattle Lakota says the clinic is tribal sovereignty in action.
And providing health care for our people. So that really changes the narrative here. We're no longer relying on Indian Health Service to provide good health care. We're doing it ourselves. So that's real sovereignty there, and we're sustainable at it.
LeBeau says insurance billing has been a big success in funding the clinic. He says it allows for other services to get brought in. LeBeau says the goal is for the clinic to receive referrals from nearby reservations. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
This week, tribal members are hoping to persuade U.S. lawmakers to revive a program that compensates people who are exposed to nuclear fallout and uranium mining. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act is particularly impactful for the Navajo Nation, where uranium mining was critical in the making of the atomic bomb. Spokesperson Justin Ahostein recalls the story of one person's battle to get help treating cancer.
Leslie Begay, who had to sell all of his livestock, who had to relocate to the city, he had to do everything he could to stay alive, and by the good acts of God, was able to receive his double lung transplant. He's one person out of the thousands of Navajo people who have been affected.
Under the RECA program, those who qualified received about a third of the cost of cancer treatment. Members of several tribes, including Navajo Nation, Laguna Pueblo, and Zuni Pueblo, raised funds to travel by bus from New Mexico to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, Navajo Nation President Boo Nigrin and Navajo Nation Council Speaker Crystalyn Curley are joining a group of U.S. lawmakers Tuesday for a press conference. They're urging House Speaker Mike Johnson to hold a vote on the legislation. Lawmakers say it's been more than 5 months since there was a bipartisan vote to strengthen the RECA program. The Oneida Indian Nation in New York is hosting four games featuring world men's and women's lacrosse teams. The 2024 World Lacrosse Box Championship Games are being held Tuesday at the tribe's Mary C. Winder Community Center. The new 90,000 square foot center is expected to welcome thousands of people for pool play matchups. The games will be broadcast nationally. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, KBOO presents Radio Zine. This episode looks at fines and fees in Oregon criminal courts. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with an overnight low of 61 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will have a chance of rain and a high of 70. Today in history, in 2014, the Mars Orbiter mission reaches Mars orbit, making India the first Asian nation to do so, and the first nation in the world to make it to Mars orbit on their first try. The quote of the day is from British writer Horace Walpole, who wrote, quote, "Men are often capable of greater things than they perform. They are sent into the world with bills of credit, and seldom draw their full extent." Ever take a flight on a commercial jet and wonder how much carbon emissions are coming from that plane? As Mike Moen reports in Minnesota, research and development is taking shape to help the aviation industry become less carbon intensive.
Some Minnesotans might already be booking flights for the upcoming holiday season. In the future, they could end up flying on a jet that relies on cleaner fuel sources, with the state at the center of evolving solutions. Sustainable aviation fuel is creating buzz in the industry as all facets of the transportation sector face increasing pressure to reduce emissions. Delta Airlines and other partners recently announced plans for a blending facility in Rosemount to combine clean sources with conventional jet fuel. Margaret Cherney Hendrick with Fresh Energy says there's an opportunity for the region to establish itself while also calling for a careful approach.
Not just from a carbon intensity perspective, but also from an environmental integrity perspective. So how are we thinking about land use conservation, water quality, air quality? All of those pieces are going to be really important as we consider how to build out our fuel pathways of the future.
Emerging sources include feedstocks derived from agriculture and green hydrogen boosted by the use of renewable energies in its production. Attorney Hendrick says Minnesota could be a big player because of its agricultural backdrop, and using state and federal incentives to spur production can aid rural economies. Global researchers warn there's still a level of uncertainty over just how effective these sources could be in reducing the emissions from a commercial jet. Fresh Energy and other clean energy and environmental groups warn that investing too much into one source could have unintended consequences. Trevor Russell with Friends of the Mississippi River says if policymakers and industry leaders go all in on corn-based ethanol, for example, other natural resources could see negative impacts.
You would really build an aviation industry that is overly reliant on summer annual row crops that are the dominant source of runoff pollution to the Mississippi River.
He says there's potential for winter oil seeds, which can be planted in concert with traditional crops without having to convert more land. As research led by institutions like the University of Minnesota plays out, airlines are seeing record demand for air travel post-pandemic. And experts say current forms of sustainable aviation fuel still represent a drop in the bucket of the fuel needed to get these planes from one city to another. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
New research is probing into the health impacts that dust from the Great Salt Lake in Utah is having on surrounding communities. The Great Salt Lake is shrinking, meaning greater areas of dry land are becoming exposed, which leads to increased levels of potentially harmful dust. One expert says more research is needed to understand the public health implications of reactive dust particles. Alex Gonzalez reports.
Utah's Great Salt Lake is shrinking, exposing more of its playa and lifting more potentially harmful dust particles into the air. A new study seeks to understand the air quality and health impacts of the dust from the drying lake. Co-author Carrie Kelly is an associate professor of chemical engineering at the University of Utah, whose team took samples from the Great Salt Lake to assess what's known as the oxidative potential of dust particles. She explains this gives researchers an indication of how materials within the dust could react with the lining of a person's lungs.
So that is important because more reactive materials and components can lead to inflammation. And inflammation, it's a very important process for all kinds of adverse health effects associated with particulate matter.
Kelly says particulate pollution has been linked to health conditions and complications from asthma to heart attack, stroke, and even premature death. When the Great Salt Lake dust samples were compared to other regional playas, they were found to be more reactive, meaning they have a higher potential for serious health effects. Kelly adds the study is the first of its kind, and more research is needed to further understand the impacts on air quality and public health. Kelly asserts climate change isn't the key driver to the shrinking of the Great Salt Lake. Instead, she says, it's been water diversions that have led to the lake reaching historically low levels.
You're taking the water, it's not making it to the lake. All of us residential and commercial consumers, we need to do our part, but agriculture is about two-thirds of the story, so we're definitely going to have to work on agriculture.
Kelly says increasing dust storms are a concern in the Salt Lake Valley, located west of Utah's densely populated Wasatch Front. The research shows 4 to 5 dust storms occur in northern Utah every year, which transport metal contaminated dust. At those times, Kelly recommends staying inside and using a mask if you must leave the house. For Utah News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Geoscientist David Padgett turns science into a tool for environmental justice. He offers his expertise to communities struggling with pollution and flooding. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Back in the 80s, as a budding geoscientist, David Padgett was immersed in numbers, and he saw no connection between his studies of the Earth and his concerns about equity and justice. Then in grad school, he learned about the environmental justice movement, and he realized he could use his skills to help communities struggling with pollution, flooding, and other environmental harms.
And it was like a light went off. I thought, wow.
Today, he's an associate professor at Tennessee State University. And he also spends a lot of time assisting communities who are fighting polluting industrial development or making the case for stronger flood protections. With his expertise, he can help communities gather and sort through scientific data that can help strengthen their arguments. And he says people of color who have suffered racial injustices often feel more comfortable working with a Black scientist like him.
There are trust issues involved. I've had communities specifically say, we want an African-American hydrogeologist who's in the Middle Tennessee area to help us. I'm like, you're stuck with me. I'm it. But I don't want to be it. I want to be able to say, oh, yeah, well, there's also this person here and that person there.
So he hopes more young Black people will see a career in the geosciences as a powerful way to help communities in need. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
A negotiated resolution of the Ukraine war would seem desirable, but the obstacles are formidable, especially for Ukraine. Kyiv views even a ceasefire as surrender at this stage of the war. As one commentator observes, Ukraine cannot win, but it cannot afford to lose. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. On the surface, a relatively easy way to stop the war in Ukraine, stop, mind you, not resolve, is for Russia and Ukraine to agree that areas Russian forces now occupy in Ukraine would belong to Russia. Those areas include the eastern Donbas region and Crimea, which Russia absorbed in 2014. Ukraine might also have to agree not to join NATO. In return, Moscow would agree to call a halt to its invasion and respect Ukraine's territorial integrity. Vladimir Putin has offered just such a proposal, whereas Volodymyr Zelensky has firmly rejected it. Zelensky will be in Washington shortly to tell President Biden he has a different plan, a plan for victory. It's hard to imagine what that might be, short of continuing the war with even more U.S. and long-range NATO weapons that can continue deep strikes into Russian territory. Complicating any proposal for a ceasefire and peace talks is public opinion in Russia and Ukraine. By all accounts, Russians support Putin's war. They have bought into his notion that Ukraine belongs to Russia and is vital to Russian security from the West. Ukrainians are equally firmly opposed to any settlement that would cede territory. As the Washington Post reports, quote, an opinion poll by the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology conducted in May found that a third of Ukrainians are now prepared to make territorial concessions to Russia if this would bring a swift end to the war and preserve Ukraine's independence. But more than half the population still rejects the idea of conceding land for peace. Earlier polling by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace found that nearly two-thirds, for instance, rejected a settlement that would freeze the current front lines, and 86% didn't trust Russia not to attack even after signing a treaty. Professor Walter Clemens, a Russia expert at Boston University, offers four reasons why negotiating with Russia at this time to end the war is not advisable. First is Moscow's imperial ambitions. Quote, a pause in the Ukraine war would permit the Kremlin to rebuild Russia's forces and, after NATO and Kyiv relax, renew its push to take all of Ukraine and go on to Moldova, the Baltic states, and elsewhere in Moscow's near abroad. Second, the Kremlin's promise of non-aggression means nothing. Russia said it would respect Ukraine's independence in 1994, when Ukraine agreed to give up its nuclear weapons. Needless to say, Russia broke that agreement. Third, no peace treaty with Putin's regime can ensure justice for war criminals. So long as Putin remains in power, he cannot and will not be punished, and nor will he allow his criminal associates to face justice. The International Criminal Court's arrest warrant includes not only Putin, but also his Commissioner for Children's Rights. Both bear responsibility for the kidnapping of some 20,000 Ukrainian children. And the fourth reason he gives, so long as the Putin regime survives, Russia will not acknowledge or pay for the damage it has inflicted on Ukraine or for the millions killed, wounded, shell-shocked, traumatized, crippled, evacuated, and forced to flee abroad. Unless you're Donald Trump, who thinks he can end the war by giving Putin whatever he wants and cutting Ukraine adrift, it's awfully difficult to find any way to find an honorable and just end to this war, certainly not with Ukraine's interests foremost. Ukraine has been invaded, a good deal of its territory seized, its cities relentlessly bombed, its economy nearly destroyed, and the lives of its people, and especially its children, damaged in innumerable ways. The chieftain of the invaders, Putin, is a war criminal. How can Ukrainians, however much they may yearn for peace, sit down with him and negotiate in good faith? And even if a territorial arrangement were agreed upon, what basis would there be for ensuring that Putin's appetite was satisfied? The foreign minister of Germany just said the other day that Moldova would surely be next if Ukraine is defeated. Since Ukraine would not be a member of a security organization, NATO, how would its new borders be protected? Then there's the overwhelming issue of rebuilding a country. That would take hundreds of billions of dollars. Who will pay the bills? Many in the European Union will shrink from such costs. In sum, bringing peace to Ukraine is even more difficult than it is to Israel-Palestine. While territorial issues are a major obstacle in both situations, and the threat of a wider war is inherent in both, in the Israel case, we at least have a phased agreement under negotiation. That agreement has reasonably clear road marks for moving from a temporary ceasefire and exchange of hostages and prisoners to a permanent ceasefire and troop withdrawals. In Ukraine, the very notion of a ceasefire is viewed as equivalent to surrender, since that would freeze Russia's territorial gains. That is why Zelensky will plead with Biden for more long-range weapons in a war Ukraine cannot win and dares not lose. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Mike Moen, Antonia Gonzalez, Farah Siddiqui, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, lovely folks like you. If you would like to become a member